This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Our Way, with yours truly, Paul Anka, and my buddy, Skip Bronson, is a production of iHeartRadio.
My father was on set. You know, it's another thing. I think I got my father teaching Robert De Niro how to be him on set. And my dad, you know, he's 70, what is he, 76 at the time, and he's a hairdresser. And he had to come and take 3 days off to come teach De Niro, you know, how to do hair on the set. And my father's like, how much am I getting for this? And I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, I'm losing clients at the salon because I got to come and teach De Niro. And I'm like, Dad, you worked with De Niro. But my dad could, you know, he didn't give a shit who it was. He was losing... He was losing dye jobs.
Hi, folks. This is Paul Anka.
And my name is Skip Bronson. We've been friends for decades, and we've decided to let you in on our late night phone calls by starting a new podcast.
And welcome to Our Way. We'd like you to meet some real good friends of ours.
They're leaders in entertainment and sports.
Innovators in business and technology, and even a sitting president or two.
Join us as we ask the questions they've not been asked before, tell it like it is, and even sing a song or two.
This is our podcast, and we'll be doing it our way.
Hey, Skip. How you doing? I was just, you know, I was looking at the Netflix of Sebastian, who's going to be on tomorrow. I was watching the show. He's brilliant, that guy. And I'm really excited to talk to him.
He really is. And you know what? For me, it's particular fun because, you know, I spend time with Sebastian. We play golf together. He's just a warm, great guy. Whenever I've had people like, I have two cousins, Marissa and Lindsay. They're huge Sebastian fans. And, you know, I hate doing this, but, can we meet him? Can we meet him? And I called him. He was out on tour. And I said, you know, I got my cousins and whatever. And everybody, you know, because not now that COVID is, you know, mostly behind us, but everybody's become more cautious about having too much contact where you're going to possibility of getting sick. Absolutely. Haven't seen me before the show. Like, it's interesting because, Paul, you like to see people after the show. He likes to see people before the show. But, you know, you have my two cousins there, and he didn't give them, like, just the handshake and goodbye. I mean, he was really, you know, he's talking to him. He's a great guy. But I was going to tell you one other thing.
Sure.
When he had his 50th birthday recently, Edie and I were invited to the party at his house, and we were driving over there, and Edie said, you know, how many people do you think will be here? I said, oh, God, Sebastian Maniscalco, hundreds. You know, it's going to be huge. We get there, there are like 30 or 40 people. And I'm wondering, wait a second, but did we get here too early and people are coming later? And I said, well, Sebastian, I thought there'd be a big crowd here. He said, listen, I perform in front of big crowds, but for something like this, I really just want the people who really mean something to me. And I mean, that's what he's like. He's thoughtful. He's not, you know, just... He's a very interesting guy. He knows that I drink Diet Coke. I'm almost addicted to it. He said, hey, hold on. Just wait here for a second. So Edie and I are just standing there. And he walks up to the house because we're out in the backyard where this party was going to take place. He comes back with a can of Diet Coke. He said, we only had one can of Diet Coke and I didn't want anybody else to get it. So I hid it in the refrigerator. Here you go. And he has a can of Diet Coke. But that's my point is that's what kind of guy he is. That's who he is. So you're going
to
love him.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that other side of him, you know, because you look at, you know, what he does up there. I'm sure there is another side. And I think we're going to find out. Thanks for pulling him in. He loves you.
Okay. We'll talk later.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye.
Say hi to Paul. Paul Anka is only on the phone because there's a Wi-Fi problem in his hotel. He's performing. 81 years old, he's performing in Clearwater, Florida. You're going to be performing when you're 80, right?
I hope so. Clearwater, Florida. What is that? The Ruth Eckert Ballroom over there?
Yeah, Ruth Eckert. Have you been down here for Bobby? Have you worked here?
Yeah, I've been there. It's a nice room.
First of all, hi, Sebastian.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Been looking forward to this. I used to hang in Chicago for many years, buddy, when it was safe.
Yeah, those were the good old days. Now, I don't know. I was just there with my father down in the city. We went to a little Italian joint down there. And, I don't know. The energy of the city seems to not be the same as it once was in the 90s when I was growing up there.
Yeah, when I went there, did you go to Gibson's? I know you're a foodie. Did you go to Gibson's, to Lombardo's place?
I didn't go to Gibson's, but I've been there. I enjoy that second old.
Yeah, that's my there. Old. That's my old hang there. We used to have a lot of fun. Marty Gatilla and Lombardo, the Greco family. But it has changed, unfortunately. But maybe it'll spin around to the way we like it.
Yeah, everything's changing.
Yeah, well, we're doing all right.
Oh, I mean, you got to be good. You're out there performing in Florida. I mean, I only hope to be 81 years old doing stand-up somewhere.
Well, I think the way you're going, you look fit. You know what I can't believe is, you know, when I got down here, I was 16 years old, Sebastian, and they said, you're doing a show called Ed Sullivan. They took me into the Ed Sullivan Theater, and 2 hours later, they said, you're going into Madison Square Gardens. We're changing the venue. And here I am, my first time in the States, singing Diana, that cockamamie little song that put me where I am today. And I was scared to death. And you're going in there. You've been selling that place out. What do you feel like, man, going from, you know, these little clubs, testing your stuff? What's the feeling going into Madison Square Gardens and as successful as you are?
Well, you know, I never got into the business to do like these arena type shows. I came out to Los Angeles from Chicago in 1998 solely to, you know, do stand-up comedy just for a living. That's kind of the goal. And you know, for me, it was a slow burn. I've been doing this for 25 years. So I didn't have any film or TV credits to really catapult me into the stand-up comedy scene. It was, you know, going to comedy clubs, doing, you know, the week at the comedy club for $1,000, whatever they were paying me, and establishing a fan base that way. And gradually over time, you know, the audience grew. And now you're going into places like Madison Square Garden, which You know, the problem with me is I never really enjoyed that experience as much as I should have because, and I don't know if you suffer from this, but I'm always thinking my last show is my last show, you know?
Right, right. I get it.
So this time around, I'm trying to stop and smell the roses a little bit more than I had in the past because, you know, these moments are fleeting. You never know if they're going to happen again. And I'm going to bring my family this time around on this tour. You know, my kids are 6 and 4 years old. They kind of understand what daddy's doing now. So just want to enjoy these moments. But yeah, Madison Square Garden is something that is, you know, as big as the room is, it plays very small. It's like an intimate type of room as much as you could get for an arena. So yeah, it's a special time. So I really, really enjoy the career right now. But again, you know, I'm selling 5 shows at Madison Square Garden, but in Norfolk, Virginia, I got 2,000 people.
Well, we don't go to Norfolk. Does the timing device, you know, it's all, I started years ago in Vegas. I had every top comic because back then, you know, they worked with us. You had Alan King, I had Woody Allen, Joe, all opening acts, and they were all into the small room environment like you started. Is there a certain device when you're playing to a big audience that you're not expecting to? What is your timing level in terms of responding to all of that? I mean, it's phenomenal. And comedy is much different than music. You know, we get up there, we can bullshit all we want because we got a band and everything, but what's your mindset when you're getting up there? I've always wondered, because it's something really a new dynamic in our business to see, you know, guys like you, and deservedly so, but with that many people, what was your timing device on that?
Well, you know, I think my act kind of is suited for a larger environment. Although I agree with you, I think the smaller rooms like the comedy clubs are somewhere where comedy should definitely be enjoyed. You know, you get into a 250 seat comedy club and the audience is right there at your feet and you could, you know, see them eating or drinking and they could see all your facial expressions. So definitely suited for comedy. But, you know, in the arena, I tend to get really physical on stage and big and theatrical. So it kind of plays to that room. But there is a little bit of a timing mechanism there that you have to slow down a little bit. Although I really like to pace my material and enjoy the silence, which, you know, I'm a huge Johnny Carson fan. I thought he had just his look alone and just the way he would stop and kind of look at the audience or look at the camera and really take his time with the joke. Because a lot of comedy is timing. And
yes.
You know, today I see a lot of comedians kind of just running through material. There is really no timing anymore, which I don't know. I feel like even though the room is 20,000 seats, you could almost, for me, the joy is just letting the silence kind of take over the room. And you could almost draw them in by just being quiet. So,
right.
Yeah, it's a different performance, not so much where it's, you know, strikingly opposite of what I'm doing in a smaller room, but yeah, there's a timing aspect there that you have to give a little bit more room for just so the audience could catch on.
Somebody, a comedian actually once told me that there are really 3 phases of comedy. The first is when you can make yourself laugh. The second is when you can make your friends laugh. And the third is when you can get people to pay you to make them laugh. So my question is, when did you realize that you could actually get paid for this?
So I fell in love with stand-up comedy really early on. I used to go over to my cousin's on Saturday and watch, I didn't have cable, and he used to tape all the, like, the Dangerfields, the Night at the Improv. I used to watch all that, and I used to be fascinated how these comedians used to memorize the stuff, and it was like it was the first time they were telling it. And then I'm like, wow, this is something I really, really enjoy watching. And then when I got into school, I really enjoyed doing book reports, getting in front of the class. I was like a shy guy. I was not the class clown. I actually despised the class clown. I was always like, sit down.
You know,
not funny. Yeah, I always had this dream of like getting into this business, but coming from the northwest suburbs of Chicago, Hollywood seemed like a different planet. But as I you know, went through my life and graduated college, I'm like, I'm going to give this a shot. And, you know, I knew it was, you know, it's a long shot, but I definitely had a work ethic instilled by my family. And they told me, you know, whatever you do it at 110%. And I didn't give myself like an out. A lot of people come to Hollywood, go, I'm going to give myself 5 years. And if I don't make anything of it, I'm going to go back home or whatever, which I think you're setting yourself up for failure by doing that. So I said, this is, you know, comedy or bust. This is the only thing I really, really enjoy doing. And I want to try and make a living at it. It was not about getting famous or celebrity or anything like that. It was strictly, I enjoy storytelling. I really love making people smile. And there's no better feeling, whether it's 20,000 people or my mother, when people laugh, to me, it creates a feeling in me. What people don't understand is, as good as they feel laughing in the audience, I feel 10 times better than what they're feeling. So, you know, in order to make a living doing it, you know, I always knew it was a business, which I take it very seriously. You know, I know how hard it is for people to come out to watch a show, you know, all that's involved, from maybe getting a babysitter to paying for the parking to, you know, fighting weather if it's snowing in the city, whatever it is. So, I mean, people are coming out to see me. So I take that very seriously, to give them a show where they will not only leave thinking, wow, I really got my money's worth, that they would leave saying to other people, you got to go see this guy. So, I have fun doing it. It's really fantastic to do stand-up comedy, but also it is a business, and I'm not blind to the fact that, you know, it is.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. People don't always realize just how much their negative thoughts and experiences stick with them and weigh them down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mom does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapist anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Paul today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Paul.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is, when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. oh, that's not this, oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sebastian, you know, most people, they never really know the mileage that performers put in that you need to get to a place where you feel you're in the vibe and you know what you're doing. And you did. You know, Bill Burr's a buddy. And he told me he ran into you years ago. Was it on Fulham Street? You guys had an apartment? Was it Fulham? I got the street wrong.
On Fuller, yeah. Hollywood, yeah.
Yeah, and Bill told me he'd always run into you and you did all your time at the comedy club and you're doing it and believing in it. You know, there comes a point, even like with us singers, you know, we have to put in mileage. We're scared to death. We're not really got a hold of ourselves. When did it kick in? What year after all that mileage were you putting in? Were you onto something? And around, you know, that whole physical vibe of yours is part of the magic of you. Like, you know, I loved Kennison. Carrie does it well. It's a two-part question. You know, one, when did it kick in for you? And when it did, who around that doesn't have the it, everything that you've got that encompasses you, that makes you laugh, that hasn't made it, that just doesn't have all of that that's going to make it happen for them, if you know where I'm going with that?
Yeah, so the first question, I realized, I don't know, I'd say 7 to 8 years in, I started to find my voice. And, you know, it was through a lot of trial and error. Young comedians come up to me and go, oh, you know, like, what do you recommend? I'm just getting into stand-up comedy. What do you recommend? I told him, I recommend you just treating this like if you were bodybuilding and you were going to do a bodybuilding show. There is hours and hours and hours that go into the gym to work every muscle that you have on your body to make it look like a statue by competition time. And that's the same thing. It's all about repetition. You know, I used to go and do comedy and, you know, 3 or 4 sets a night, Monday through, you know, Saturday. I think I maybe took Sunday off, but I felt like if I was taking a night off, I was almost like doing myself a disservice because I would miss out on a learning experience on stage. You know, every time you got up there, something would happen, whether it be a heckler or you would get into a almost like this zone of improving on stage with just one idea. And I also felt like, who's in the audience? You know, I don't know who's in that audience. There's somebody that could come in and go, wow, this guy's funny. Let's give him a shot here or there. So the more stage time I got, the more chances I felt like it would give me not only to practice, but get myself in front of the right people. And as far as people today who I think are funny or what have you, I don't know. It's a hard question, I guess, to ask. I'm not piped into the comedy scene as far as like going to comedy clubs and going, oh, that cat's funny, this girl's funny, or what have you. I mean, Nate Bargatze seems to be a guy who seems to be setting his audience. He's really coming up. We're going to do a show here and at the Netflix as a joke at the Hollywood Bowl together with Gaffigan and Seinfeld. But I guess I don't know a lot of young comedians on their way up that either have it or maybe don't have it. I don't know. I don't know, Paul. Listen, I got 2 kids, 6 and 4. I barely got time for my own comedy, let alone anybody else.
Do they get what you're doing, Sebastian? Are they into it? Because my kids fluffed me off with my music for a long time. But are they hip to what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, they've been to a couple of shows. They know Daddy makes people laugh. You know, and for me also, too, you know, the struggle being a performer is I'm a father first, and I want to be with my family for those moments. You know, my daughter has a gymnastics meet tomorrow at 7:30 in the morning. And, you know, I've been invested in this gymnastics. I've been to every meet. And then I'm starting to think, man, when I start touring in July, you know, some of these moments I'm not going to be able to go to. And I know you can't go to everything, but you know, there's that struggle there with me too, going, geez, you know, I don't want to look back, you know, 20 years from now going, what the hell was I doing in you know, Norfolk, Virginia, July 11th, when my daughter was doing a recital, and I missed it.
I hear you.
There's that whole thing.
You know, I went through it, Sebastian. I have five girls, and I got nine grandchildren, and you got to put the quality time in, because you're doing what you're doing because you love it. They got to get it, but it's all quality time and not quantity.
No, I agree. I think that's definitely true. It's not so much all these hours, but it's the hours that mean a lot that you got to concentrate on. But yeah, they're kind of aware of it. My daughter more so than my son, but yeah, they know that daddy's a clown.
Yeah. So Paul was talking about your physical comedy. Before I get into this anecdote, full disclosure, Sebastian and I are friends. Play golf together. We hang out together.
And he tells me every day, Sebastian, every day he calls, this guy kills me. I love this guy. He's very fond of you, as you know.
Well, Skip's a great guy.
One evening I'm home and I get a phone call. Phone lights up, says Sebastian's name. He said, you know, listen, I'm down here in Mobile, Alabama. He said, I'm doing a film, feature film, called About My Father. So the most incredible thing is I had pictures of Robert De Niro on my walls when I was a kid, and now Robert De Niro is playing my father in this movie. I mean, somebody's got to pinch me. But I got a problem here. I said, what's the problem? He said, well, my back is killing me. I got this pain going down my leg. I don't know what to do. I think, you know, somebody said I got to get an epidural. I'm in Mobile. I don't know who to get an epidural from. I said, so what are you calling me for? He said, because you know everybody, so I figured you'd know somebody. I said, you figured I'd know somebody in Mobile, Alabama, who can give you an epidural? So I call my friend Neil Eletrage, who's probably the greatest orthopedic surgeon in America. And I call him, I tell him the story. And he said, well, I don't know anybody in Mobile, but I got a doctor. I think he said he was in Montgomery. It's like about an hour and a half away in a car. I said, will he make a 3-hour round trip? I said, I think so. He's really struggling and he's got to make this movie. So Neil made a phone call. Next thing we know, you're off to see this doctor who shot you up and, you know, got you through this so that you could get the film done.
Can you imagine? I'm in Alabama. I'm calling Skip in LA asking if he knows anybody to help me out in Alabama. Next thing you know, I think I was in Birmingham face down on a doctor's table with a needle about 12 inches long going into my spine.
And you're doing your first film. You're with De Niro. You're learning a script, all of that perfect stuff. And it shows you it's an imperfect world. How the hell do you get through that? How do you do that with that pain and having to address that and knowing what that process is like doing a film? I mean, how did you get through it?
You know, every morning I was stretching, I was working out, I was trying to keep myself loose and limber, but no matter kind of what I did, it really didn't help my sciatic pain. Recently I've taken up Pilates, and I found that Pilates is the best thing for, you know, posture and core stability and all that. But getting through that movie, it was not a good experience for me. For multiple reasons. A, I was in severe pain. B, I felt like, you know, I've never done a movie from soup to nuts like that. And I'm doing it with arguably one of the greatest who's ever done it. So there was a lot of doubt in whether or not I could accomplish this feat. So I was really, really in my head, but I learned a ton from working with De Niro. And for me, it was like a 10-week intensive acting class for me. I've acted before in movies, but nothing to this level. So I kind of took that experience and used it as a learning experience for future projects. But yeah, my father was on set. You know, it's another thing. I think I got my father teaching Robert De Niro how to be him on set. And my dad, you know, he's 70, what is he, 76 at the time, and he's a hairdresser, and he had to come and take 3 days off to come teach De Niro, you know, how to do hair on the set. And my father's like, how much am I getting for this? And I'm like, what? Yeah, I'm losing clients at the salon because I got to come and teach De Niro. And I'm like, Dad, yeah. De Niro, but my dad could he didn't give a shit who it was. He was losing he was losing dye jobs.
Were you giving De Niro any comedy tips? I mean, he's done comedy before, but I mean, it was so personal. I saw the film. It was wonderful. Are you giving him, I mean, do you dare give him any tips? Because we all know Bobby. He's a sweetheart, and he's just so talented. Did you lay anything off on him in terms of comedy tips because it was so personal for you?
Yeah, I mean, he had asked me a couple of questions in regards, like, you know, how would your father do this or that? But the relationship between him and I on set was very... it's very distant, you know, like it's like cut, and it's not like we were just hanging out going, hey, Bob, what are you doing tonight for dinner? You know, it was none of that. It was, he went to his chair and I think got on the phone and opened up another Nobu. And I was, you know, in my line. So he was very professional. He helped me a lot with the acting, but as far as like kind of shooting there was not a lot of, number one, not necessarily because of him, it was because of me too, because I was trying to, you know, not learn my lines, but like figure out what I was going to do. And yeah, it was, there was no real tips offered my way to him, but definitely the other way around.
And did you get along with your father?
You didn't want my father to leave. So
he didn't.
No, he's like, where are you going? And my dad's like, I gotta work, Bob. And
Bob.
And he's like, no, you gotta stay here and help me. And my dad's like, you know, I can't. I gotta go back. I gotta go back home. So it was definitely a great experience, and to share that with my father and my family, my mother, my wife, my sister, all of us. It was definitely something I never saw in the cards for me. But I mean, I got a movie out there that Robert De Niro's playing my father. So if it all ended for me today, I think I'm all right.
Yeah, it was a great film.
You know, when you were talking, you and Paul were talking about Madison Square Garden, which to me, that's the ultimate. I mean, if you perform and you go to any athlete, basketball player, hockey, there's something magical about being in Madison Square Garden. I mean, it's just, it's the pinnacle. But what was like the worst place you ever performed?
Worst place. I think it was up in Manteca. It was Northern California. I think it's the meth capital of the world. And the problem with stand-up comedy is people think they could throw that. You just throw it up anywhere, whether it be a restaurant or whatever. It's like, oh, we're going to have comedy tonight. But really, you need kind of a stage, a lighting. But this was in a boxing ring. It was a bar that had a boxing ring in the bar, and behind the boxing ring was a bowling alley. And we arrived, as me and two other comedians, and we're like, where's the show? And they're like, it's going to be in the boxing ring tonight. And I said, oh, okay. So, you know, no introduction, no nothing. You just get in the boxing ring. There's fresh blood on the canvas from the evening before. And, you know, they don't even know comedy is happening. They're drinking at the bar, watching sports, which is another thing. It's like they still kept the sports on while comedians on stage. And, you know, I'm doing comedy, you know, to whatever, 23 people in a sports bar while somebody's picking up a spare behind me. So, but you need those nights, you know. You know, talking about like the difference today in comedy and anything in entertainment now, opposed to, you know, back when you had to put in the reps and do the work and whatnot, there is no substitute for that. There's, you know, I don't care how many Instagram videos you put out in your living room, there is no substitute than for actually going out and getting in front of a live audience and performing, whether you're a singer, a dancer, a comedian. Those definitely lay the foundation for your career and make you a seasoned pro. So, you know, I relished those nights. At the time, I was like, you know, I was scared up there. You know, I was reeling. But you need those moments in your career, because when you're performing in front of Madison Square Garden and something goes awry or someone, you know, I was in Atlantic City at the Brigada and I was performing in the round and there was a commotion in the crowd. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a fight. I thought something had happened. Maybe somebody keeled over and had a heart. I don't know what was going on, but they had to stop the show because there was a variety of different sections that were having this issue where there was commotion. And I had to get off stage for them to figure out what was going on. And I was backstage going, what's going on? That we don't know. It turned out that someone threw up and it caused a chain reaction amongst the audience. And everybody who saw the throw up started to throw up. So we had about five or six different people hacking on, you know, they had to bring a hazmat team in to clear the vomit. And then I had to go up, you know, after a 40 minute break, I had to go back up and finish the show. So, you know, if I didn't have those reps before that happened, I would have been totally lost on how to like handle that situation. But, you know, I got up there and I, you know, made kind of fun of the whole, what had happened, and then, you know, moved on with my material. So, yeah, I mean, you never know what's going to happen in a live show. And if you don't have those reps behind you, I think it's a disservice.
Yeah, I've seen so much of that. And if you're not ready for it, it throws you. I'll never forget Toadie Fields. You remember the comic Toadie Fields?
No.
Anyway, she was one of the, I love talking to you because all the guys I grew up with, everyone I talk to today has never heard of Alan King, Jerry Lewis, yeah. Of course, right?
I know them, yeah. Tony Field and
so she hires this French singer, Charles Aznavour. Have you heard of him?
No.
So anyway, Charles Aznavour is a Frank Sinatra of France. I mean, huge. And when he came to this country, eventually did big business. She gets it in her head to bring him down to Miami. I think it was the Fountain Blue or the Eden Rock. And they hired this French singer who sings in French. And he opens the show for Toadie Fields, places jammed. You know, Miami was the place run by the boys. Everybody was there. It was the glamour spot. And this guy gets up and starts singing in French. And some woman in the front stands up and she goes, Sadie, what time are you going to the pool tomorrow? Well, that was it. The act was over. Everybody left. They didn't want to watch him, but he came off. He said, look, I've never had this, but I'm prepared for it. But you're so right. When you get those instances, I've had people with heart attacks in the audience, fights in the audience. You got to really hold your ground on how to handle it because it throws the shit out of you. You're not prepared.
Paul, tell Sebastian the story about what happened the time with your tooth when you were performing.
Oh, Jesus. You know, as a kid, I played hockey, so, you know, I got banged up between the nose and the teeth. So I had a cap in the front that they kept fixing as the technology got better. Anyway, I'm playing the Bally's in Las Vegas, and I got this dentist put in the new cap up in front. And, you know, I said, okay, cool. So I go on stage, and I'm in about 10 minutes. I don't know what happened, but I started singing some high note, and my tongue hit the tooth, and the fucking tooth flew out right ringside. I'm going, what the fuck? What the fuck? Now this woman is standing up. I'm singing. I got the lip rolled around the teeth. I have your tooth, Mr. Anka.
Oh, my God.
I took the tooth. I canceled the show. I almost killed the dentist. I went back, got it fixed, but I'll never forget that night. I got your tooth, Mr. Anka. Those are moments you're not prepared for, Sebastian.
Oh,
I
no,
can promise
no.
you.
I don't think anything could prepare for your teeth falling out on stage.
Well, thank God it was just one. One.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community.
Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Your most recent comedy special, Is It Me? You know, you taped that in Vegas, and you wore a tuxedo. Why was that? Why did you get all dressed up like that?
You know, I grew up in a family where you kind of dressed up, you know, like you're going out, put on your nice slacks. We're going to dinner, you're going to church, you know, put on your Sunday's best. And I would hear these stories, you know, particularly from my parents saying, oh, you should have been around when Vegas was Vegas, you know, and the Rat Pack was there. Everybody was dressed to the nines and, you know, suit and cocktail dresses. And now you go to Vegas and the woman's labia is hanging out on the blackjack table. You know, it's like, there's no like class or decorum. You know, you got men walking around in bathing suits and flip flops throwing the dice. So I'm like, you know, I want to pay homage to kind of old school Vegas, and kind of dress up. I asked the audience to wear tuxedos and cocktail gowns, and let's bring kind of like that old world back to Vegas. And you know, looking back on that special, I typically don't perform in tuxedos, so it does restrict my movement a little bit. And then the audience, I'd say maybe 25% of them dressed up. And we had to move the people that were in tuxedos to the front because it looked like no one really even listened to the request of dressing up. So, yeah, I mean, you know, and Paul, you could probably speak to this, you know, work in Vegas in the mob era. Did you perform there and just get handed a sack of cash on the way out? How'd that work?
I went to the underworld. I don't say nothing. you know, I started there in 58. I worked for the boys, but they ran everything. You worked the Copa, Fountain Blue, Vegas. When you worked there, it was legitimate. I mean, in terms of your payment, you know, working with Frank and Sammy and Dean, we had a lot of licenses where we took advantage. But by and large, till the G came in and started getting heavy on them, you'd get a check. I was earning maybe $15,000 a week doing two shows a night. I'd get a check, but they were the best to work for. You shook their hands. You had a deal. Nothing like these characters today. You didn't even need a contract. They protected you. Anything you wanted, you got. You got paid, as I said, legitimately. There was no under-the-table cash. The fallacy was there wasn't a lot of money around then, Sebastian. You know, the government and everybody that was all over them felt they were making millions. You know, I'd go in the back room where they were counting the cash, and maybe there was like 50,000, 70,000. They would make nothing, and they'd divvy it up in St. Louis and Chicago. But there wasn't a lot of money. So we weren't really living with a lot of cash. I mean, we'd play around at the tables. You know, we'd get markers that give us chips. You know, sometimes he wouldn't pay the markers. And then sometimes the dealers who we knew, they were mechanics, they had single decks. They'd come in and they, you know, we're all buddies. We'd tip them. You'd say, hit me. He'd say, nah, you don't want it. They'd hit and break. So it was that kind of camaraderie. But in terms of getting cash, no. The cash flew out of the casinos, out of the back rooms, and it was divvied up all over the country. And as I said, later on, when I stayed in Vegas, I've been there for years, they were bringing Brinks trucks up to the MGM and to Steve Wynn's places with millions that they'd put in the cages. But back then, with the boys in the 60s, there was not a lot of cash floating around. It just didn't exist.
Yeah, I just feel, and Paul, listen, even if you got cash, you're not going to tell me on a podcast that you were walking away with sacks of cash. Believe me, I'm Italian. I understand the you know what you have to say. But in regards to like them treating the talent like, you know, I mean, nowadays it's so corporate. I mean, you ask for one thing and it's got to go through seven different people in order for you to get something in the dresser. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
So it's, again, I don't know. I felt like
totally different.
Yeah. I felt like I was born in the wrong era sometimes.
Well, you know what? You're right. Because the way that I saw it before Steve Wynn changed it, it was so free. It was so loose in terms of everybody respecting each other. Everybody there for each other. It was a hang. Anything that we wanted, the boys were there and they'd give it to you and it got done right on the moment. And they were just the best to work for. I loved working for those guys. I just loved it. And we missed them because when they came in, you know, and took over, Howard Hughes was the turning point. That's when Frank had his big fights there. They just wouldn't give him anything anymore. And he, you know, I'm not going to divvy up on what, but he had some major encounters with him and he moved to Caesar's Palace and we all ultimately went over there. But they were the guys. You got everything instantly. They couldn't do enough for you. You know, I was never owned by them. I was a kid doing well for them. Nobody ever muscled me. They were gentlemen, these guys. And every day they were dressed appropriately. They handled you appropriately. When the day was done, they'd rip up the showroom, bring in a work light, sit down and they play gin for a dollar a point, take their coats off. And it was very to the order of the way they liked their life. I loved those days. When it got corporate, it got real weird.
And now, Paul, you know, Sebastian has a long-term deal with the Wynn Encore, a residency, if you will, which is great because for all of us who still work, you know, it's not the work, it's the travel. I mean, travel is just, I was talking to Doc Rivers once, our friend, the basketball coach. They were going out on a 5-game road trip. I said, what's the toughest thing about a 5-game road trip? He said, the packing. You know, it's not the playing. It's not not the practice. It's the packing. But now, you know, with this deal that you've got in Las Vegas, living in LA, and it's just a 40-minute hop over there. How many shows do you have lined up?
Actually, I'm going there this weekend. And then I got one more Memorial Day weekend in May. And then I'm going to give Vegas a little rest while I go on this It Ain't Right tour starting in July through April. I'm going to kind of stay out of Vegas and just pop around different places in North America and Canada we're going to do. I love Vegas. You know, Friday and Saturday night, you leave Friday, you come back Sunday and talk, and no real wear and tear on your body traveling. I mean, I don't know. I'm 50 and I'm starting to definitely feel the aches and pains of years and years of, you know, sitting in those seats. And you know, I don't know how to sit in a plane seat still. I'm crossing my legs. I'm sliding down on the chair. I still don't even know how to even get comfortable on these things. So
what are you flying, Sebastian? What kind of plane you flying?
What kind of plane? Well,
are you a private? You're going private?
Sometimes I do when it's like hard to get to a place commercially, and it's kind of a tight turnaround. I generally fly on a private aircraft, and depends. Maybe sometimes I'm flying with my family. I'll do it. I don't do it as much as I used to, just because, you know, I mean, there's a cost involved to flying private. You know, everybody's like, oh, yeah, so fly private. Well, I mean, yeah, it's 50 grand, you know, to fly private, but it's $1,000 to fly commercial. And I don't got any problem boarding an airplane as a, you know, just to save myself 49K.
But listen, airports and flying today ain't like it was years ago. It ain't easy.
No, it's not. It's
the
not
way
easy.
They're canceling the stuff that's going on. It ain't easy. I mean, we do it. But the luxury of the other, you've kind of earned it because you want to get somewhere and be rested. But I've never seen, you know, I travel all over the world. The Asian airports, the European airports, they're sensational. But, you know, God bless our country. You don't know if you're going to get on a flight in 2 days. The crap that's going on in our country, it's unfortunate. And I feel for everybody, and I do it. My band gets stuck places for 2 days. It's just not like it was, man. And
like you said,
when you got to get in somewhere, it's good to have that to preserve yourself. I mean, yeah. I hear you with your bones at 50, but come sit with me at 82, and I'll give you a couple of little lessons.
And, you know, you talk about the time also as a time factor, that, you know, time is so precious. And that's what I was going to ask. You know, I know Sebastian's a foodie. And you had a show on the Food Network called Well Done that I thought was great, but you don't do it anymore. Why is that? Just curious.
You could ask our friend David Zasloff. No, I had this show on Discovery, and it was fun. I mean, the whole intention of the show was I had interests in the food world, and I was like, how do I marry the culinary world with the comedy world? And we came up with this idea of, like, I'm interested in how sushi gets made. And we went out and we talked to the best sushi chefs, and they taught us how to make sushi. And I really had fun doing it. It's just that, you know, the show, I guess they wanted more of a for whatever the reason, you know, they don't renew these things. We tried to get it somewhere else, but it just didn't fly, but it was good for a while lasted. We did it during COVID, and I really enjoyed it. If there's an opportunity to do a Well Done 2.0, I'm definitely up for it. But you know, I kid about David. He definitely gave me a shot at a time where I really needed it. And then subsequently we're doing the show now with Chuck Lorre on Max called Bookie.
Yeah, the first season was great.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. oh, that's not this, oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Sebastian, how many times have you been to Italy, and where do you like to eat over there? That's my hang. I love it over there.
Yeah, so my father and I went back. I went for the first time, I think it was 2014, maybe 10 years ago. And my father hadn't been back since he left. So it was 50 years. He was going back for the first time with me. And, it was something else. He grew up in a small town in Sicily called Cefalù, which is about an hour east of Palermo. And we went back. And he's showing me all the, you know, this is where I learned to play soccer. This is where your grandfather had his barber shop. And I'm crying, right? And he ain't doing nothing. My dad's like stone face. And even while I'm crying, I go, nothing? Dad, you ain't feeling nothing? You're here with your son where you grew up. And you act like we're at Target. You know, like, where's the emotion? And later on, he said, I was in shock when I was there. I didn't really even take it all in. He went back again without me, and he felt it then. But while he was there, he was really, really kind of taken aback by the whole experience. And since then, my wife and I have gone for our honeymoon. We really love the Amalfi Coast there. And we went to Tuscany, Florence. I like the food better in the south. Not that I'm not into the northern food, but the further south you go, I believe the food is far above what you would get in a place like Milan. I mean, especially in Sicily, there's so many different cultures of food there, you know, because it's been conquered so many times. You have a lot of Middle Eastern influence there as well. So yeah, it's a great place. Every time I go someplace other than Italy, I tell my wife, why didn't we go to Italy? You know, we went to Turkey one year, Istanbul, and it's nice, but you know, I'm walking around going, why didn't we just go to Florence? Why do we got to try anything else? I'm very partial to Italy.
Yeah, I go every year. I mean, I lived there in the 60s. Ennio Morricone was my arranger, and I was recording in Italian. So I got smitten with a place, you know, when I was just a kid. And I go back every year, and daughter lived over there. And I agree, it's the best hang for me every summer to go over there. They've held that tradition, and it's unlike anywhere else in the world, unless you go to Asia and get into that Asian thing. But Italy's the best. Italy's the best, yeah.
And our producer, Jordan, has an Italian connection. Jordan, you should jump in here and tell Sebastian. He'll get a kick out of it.
My girlfriend's name is Cefalù, and they're from Cefalù. We were there over the summer. They're from Porticello in Cefalù. We go there all the time. They still got family there. Beautiful place. I know Cefalù well.
Wow. You don't run into a lot of people that know about the town. And once you get there, it's like, you know, along that Lungo Mare, that street there, and the town itself is so small and quaint and has a lot of charm. It's a real, real beautiful place. That's so odd. And even her last name is the town.
Yeah, I got a question for you. My mother was half Italian and half Sicilian, and she always made the distinction. I'm half Italian, half Sicilian. I'm not Italian. I'm half. And everybody I know that is half Italian or partially Italian, partially Sicilian, they're very clear about making the distinction. What is the difference to you? Do you ever articulate the difference between being Italian and Sicilian? And if there is a difference, what is it?
I don't know. The Sicilians I know, it's almost like there's a rivalry between the North and the South in Italy. So I think that's why people are very...
Yeah,
kind of passionate about, hey, I'm Sicilian, I'm not Italian. But I grew up more on the Sicilian side as far as my family is concerned, like my father and their, I think they had more influence. Although my mother always listens to these podcasts and she's like, why don't you ever talk about me? And you know, my mom is like, how come I'm not in your act? You know, people got died. So, but yeah, my mother's side was very kind of quiet, reserved. My mom was kind of shy. My grandparents on my mother's side, although we saw them a lot, were just kind of a reserved people. But then you go on my father's side, the Sicilian side, and that's where all the characters are. That's where all the kind of the loud and kind of boisterous, you know, personalities are on that side. And I thought that side was just there's a lot more comedy going on that side where I could extract from how they were behaving or how my father behaves to my mother, that's kind of where I went with the comedy. But the difference is, I don't know, for me, it was a little bit more the volume. The Sicilians had more volume and more heated arguments than maybe the my mother's side. I don't know if you're feeling that with your wife, Jordan, but I take it by your last name, you are nowhere near Italian.
No, I'm half. My mother was half Sicilian, half Italian, and Caleri was my Sicilian side. But yeah, no, that scans from every, just half Northern Italian, half Sicilian. That you definitely got more of the characters and more of the volume from that, from the Southern half.
Yeah.
You know, Paul has fans that, you know, will go to his concerts over and over again. And I remember when, you know, I was working with Wynn, you know, we had Garth Brooks, and the people would say, oh yeah, this is the 52nd time I've seen it. But it doesn't really happen with comedians, right? I mean, unless the act changes. In other words, if you did your routine, let's say hypothetically at the Wynn Encore, you don't get people that go and see the same act over and over the way they would for Paul or other singers, right? It's not the same.
No. I mean, there are people that come and see the same thing over and over again in comedy, but it's nowhere near the amount of people that come to sing the same song at a concert, you know, year in and year out. So that's the challenge for comedians is, you know, people, yeah, you know, they, you know, once you hear a joke, you know where it's going, and they want to hear something new. So in this day and age where all your material basically is online, you have to, you're almost forced to come up with new material every time you go out on tour. Whereas before, you know, in the 80s, these a lot of comedians, they toured with the same material year in and year out just because there was no way for anybody to see it. You know, there was no internet back then. So you could go to a city time and time again and maybe get away with doing the same act. But now the exposure is so abundant that there's no way you could go on you know, come to do another show in Chicago with the same material, you'd be booed.
I love the way you get to change it up, though, because Billy Joel's done, 100 shows at Madison Square Garden, and he's basically singing the same song over and over and over, right? I mean, but you get to change it up.
Different. But let me, on that point, that's an interesting point, Sebastian and Skip. In trying to stay contemporary and current, and having to prepare it, at what point in there, in the timing aspect, does it maybe become old in preparing it and going, shit, I'm too late on this? How do you assess that to stay current, but keep the timing of it and it not get old? Like a lot of the political stuff, you see some comics are dealing with political terms. Well, it's by the time they finished writing it and doing it, it's old. It must be a concern trying to stay fresh on what's happening in a contemporary sense, if you know where I'm going.
Yeah, I think if you're doing a lot of material in the political forum, that it could be dated and maybe current events, you know. But I like to kind of keep my material broad in the sense where, hey, you know, my family and I just went to Universal Studios. This is what happened at Universal Studios. Now, I could do that tonight at a show, and I could probably do that 3 years from now. And it's still relevant, just because, you know, it's not a current event or something that's happening that people, it's like a fleeting moment. So I like to really draw from my own life experience. And I was just talking to Jay Leno the other day about, you know, he doesn't have like an assistant that goes and runs errands for him. He does it himself. And that's the way you come up with material. You got to go live your life. You got to be out there. You know, you can't be isolated in your house. At least I can't. I don't sit at a desk writing material. I got to go and see things and experience, you know, the recital at school. I just went to a parent-teacher conference yesterday for my four-year-old son. They ain't doing calculus over there, but, you know, I go not only because it's my wife and I, you know, do everything together, but, you know, there's morsels of material that come, you know, like I even asked, and this is just an idea I had yesterday. I go, well, my kid acts up here. Is there like a punishment? Do we like, because growing up, I used to stand on the wall at recess facing the wall. And the teachers are like horrified. They're like, no, we don't do that here. If they do act up, they get to sit at a table and do a table choice. I go, but the table. So it's like, I always find a lot of humor in, this is the way I grew up. This is what we did. And this is what we're doing now. And a lot of people could relate to that, just because, you know, I used to do this doorbell bit where, you know, this is how the doorbell rings back in the 80s. And now the doorbell rings now. This is what happens. So it's like a multi-generational bit where, you know, if you lived in the 80s, you get it. If you live now, you get it. And everybody in between. So a lot of my material is based in that kind of setup, just because I just think it's always fun to compare, you know, generations and whatnot. Not to say that one's better than the other. It's just that the slant is, you know, I don't know. I grew up on the wall. I turned out pretty good. So why not for my son, you know?
Yeah, I get it. Hey, Sebastian, are you able to, with all this amazing success, are you able to enjoy your success now?
No. Here's another thing I wrestle with. You know, I'm trying, not that you need to spend money to enjoy your success, but I always look at my career going, you know, what's enough? Like, how much is enough? Like, how much do you need to live and do this or do that? And once you start, you know, I don't have like a guideline. I didn't grow up this way. I grew up in a working middle-class family. So, you know, I grew up in a family where if we didn't eat at dinner, like our food, my father would eat everybody's food because it was wasteful, you know? And I still have that mentality. I feel like I grew up during the Depression, like it's going to go away. So I have that mentality, which is good to have. But you need to kind of loosen up, you know, like, I don't know. I still have that kind of working class mentality, but I'm living in a different class of people. So I always, you know, like everybody out in LA, this is, you know, Skip could relate to this. Everybody, especially at the golf course, everybody's got a second home, right? You got to go, I got a place in Cabo. You got to go to Cabo, you got to get a place in Cabo. And I'm like, for what?
I hear you.
I'd rather stay at the guy's place that bought it in Cabo rather than me and leave. Because I know how much it I got a home. I know how much it takes to like run this place. And there's no way I could have a second home somewhere else. I'd drive myself nuts.
Been there, done that.
Speaking of driving yourself nuts, this has been great. And I've got to go because I got to practice because you and I are playing golf Tuesday. Don't forget.
Yeah, no, Skip is facilitating my membership into a golf club, and he's working miracles over there.
He's the miracle worker. He's the miracle worker. That's Skip. Hey, Sebastian, I must tell you, I respect you, I enjoy you, and I got to thank you for taking out the time, man. I really appreciate it, and I will continue to think good things for you because I really enjoy what you're doing with your life. Stay with it.
Well, that's very sweet of you. And I know maybe we could get this orchestrated through Skip because he's kind of the guy who's the mayor of the town. But let's when you're back in town, let's all break some bread somewhere. I know Skip went to Stella last night. Maybe we all could go and have a nice Italian meal together and share some war stories.
Yeah, and you come up play Sherwood. I live out in Lake Sherwood. We got a pretty good golf course out there. Have you ever played it?
I don't want you to lose your – listen, I don't want you to lose your membership.
I've lost it already. We've had everybody out there. Skip, you got to bring him out to Lake Sherwood one day.
I don't know. His game right now is available for home games only. I don't know if we're going I don't know if we're going on the road yet.
Okay. Sebastian, take care of yourself, man. Good talking to you.
Thanks for having me. And nice to meet you.
Thanks, Sebastian.
Take care, guys.
Thanks.
Be good. I'll see you Tuesday, Skip.
See ya. You got it.
Our Way with Paul Anka and Skip Bronson is a production of iHeartRadio.
The show's executive producer is Jordan Runtag, with supervising producer and editor Marcy DePina.
It was engineered by Todd Carlin and Graham Gibson and mixed and mastered by Doug Bohm.
If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review.
For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
even working with you from Kerry Hilson, Adonis. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school like, yeah. Okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.